This is session 16 of our trip through Revelation. We'll be discussing the Lamb and the Scroll with Seven Seals, the 144,000 and the Great Multitude, Part 1. This is Revelation Chapter 7. We didn't actually meet this last Saturday, so I am recording basically a run-through of the outline, rather than a discussion. To begin with, I want to kind of place ourselves in the proper frame of reference, and remind ourselves where we are in this journey. The backdrop of this chapter is that we are in the throne room, the temple in heaven. God is on the throne, and the Lamb is in the process of opening the scroll by breaking each of its seals. We have now gone through six of the seals. In this throne room, in this temple, there are four living creatures, there are 24 elders, there are angels, and just the heavenly host is present in this scene. We need to remind ourselves that the events that are being described as each seal is opened are not the contents of the scrolls themselves. We've already noted in the past that the contents of the scroll we assume is the names in the Book of Life. And so these seals then function to protect and to authenticate the names that are contained in the book. So six of the seven seals have been opened so far. We've seen four horsemen, our martyr's church, and the judgment day of the Lord. And with this sixth seal that was opened, a question was asked. Who can stand? That was the question at the end of the sixth seal. Although no answer was given at that point, given the language and the imagery that was presented at that scene, no one is the presumed answer. No one can stand. And we've seen that in chapter 6, as the seals were being opened, each one was opened in rapid succession. And so the audience who is seeing this theatrical production, this stage play, this hearing Revelation being read, would now assume that the seventh seal would be opened, and with it the culmination of judgment, perhaps. And so that's the frame of reference, the background in which we now read chapter 7. And although we're going to focus our discussion primarily on the first half of this chapter, just to get the context, I'm going to read the entire chapter. It's not too terribly long. So, chapter 7. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on earth or sea or against any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had given power to harm earth and sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. 12,000 from the tribe of Judah were sealed, 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 from the tribe of Gad, 12,000 from the tribe of Asher, 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000 from the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000 from the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 from the tribe of Levi, 12,000 from the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 from the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 from the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 from the tribe of Benjamin were sealed. After this, I looked, And behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these, clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve Him day and night in His temple, and He who sits on the throne will shelter them with His presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and He will guide them to springs of living water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." Someone who had just heard that might question, hey, where's the seventh seal? After all, now we're talking about the seven seals, so what happened to this seventh? No. It's as if a pause button is pressed in the opening of the scroll by breaking the seals, and it appears as if the judgment of the sixth seal is prevented from moving forward. The audience still has in the back of their mind the question, who can stand? And now that question appears to be answered. There are five angels that are pictured in this chapter. The first four are holding the winds back. And then the fifth, another angel, goes forth, and the audience sees the question, who can stand? That begins to be answered. And the answer is, the servants of God. They can stand. And then John hears the number, 144,000. 144,000 is one of those numbers in the book of Revelation, and one of those numbers that throughout history of the Bible, throughout Christendom, it's been debated. What is 144,000? Is it literal? Is it symbolic? Who does it represent? What does it represent? We noted that in our discussion of the fifth seal that there was a number that was waiting for completion. And so is this 144,000 that number? Now that's certainly a valid question. What about this great multitude that follows in the second half of the chapter? Of chapter 7. Now, is this the same as the 144,000, or is it a different group? Now, because, at least on the surface, the way the words are found, the first half of the chapter shows that this 144,000 are certainly numbered. There's a definite number. On the other hand, in the second half, this great multitude, John records that what he saw was a multitude that no one could number. So, on the surface then, it would seem that these are two different groups. But are they, really? In our discussion of the fifth seal, going back to the fifth seal again, we noted that this great multitude in chapter 7 is probably the same as the martyr church that is described in the fifth seal. And we can also note that In the sixth seal, everyone on earth appeared to be represented. Now if we go back to the actual text of that fifth seal, let me just turn to that quick. It's Revelation chapter 6. About verse 15. Then the kings of the earth, and the great ones, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. So, at least in the way the language is found there, it would seem to include everyone, with no exception. Yet we now see that, you know, in chapter 7, the everyone of chapter 6, the sixth seal, does not necessarily include literally everyone, because it excludes the servants of God who are now sealed in chapter 7. What we find in chapter 7 is in verse 9, we see a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and people and languages. So, again, it's a universal group. But what's interesting is that there's no mention of the great ones. Now, it's interesting that there is no one in this group that is described as great, whereas in the sixth seal, now, there are the kings, the great ones, the generals, the rich, and the powerful are specifically mentioned and pointed out. The actions of these two groups, the everyone of the sixth seal and the everyone of chapter 7, there's a parallel there. In the sixth seal, they cry out to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb." In other words, you know, they're seeking kind of a, quote, salvation by asking the rocks to fall on them, because they cannot face the Lamb. They cannot face Jesus. They cannot face God. On the other hand, the multitude in chapter 7 also cry out. But they cry out, and they cry out for salvation too. But the source of salvation is different. In verse 10 of chapter 7, they cry out, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." In this chapter as well, the living creatures and the elders once again come to the forefront of the scene. They come forward to take part. The elders have been worshiping at the end of chapter 5, but we have not heard of them until now. The creatures, the four living creatures, had announced the first four seals, but had gone silent after that for the fifth and sixth seals. But now with the great multitude, there is a new hymn of praise that they join in. And this new hymn of praise combines praises that we already saw in chapters 4 and 5. And one of these elders comes to speak with John about those clothed in white robes. And by specifically pointing out the great multitude, the elder highlights that this great multitude are of particular interest to Revelation, and therefore they should be of particular interest to John and to us. It's mentioned that they're the ones that have come out of the Great Tribulation. Well, what is the Great Tribulation? What is it? backtrack all the way to the seven letters, and the letter to Smyrna mentioned that God's people, or not God's people, but that certain people would go through tribulation, or that they would, that those who actually, it was that the letter mentioned that the church would undergo a period of tribulation. So is this the reference? But there was also another reference to some kind of a trial that Philadelphia would go through. But in this case, it was not the church, but those who refused to follow Jesus who would undergo trials. So does this great tribulation have anything to do with any of those things? Well, that's a question that we can ask. Now, there's an interesting paradox that's found in this chapter, the idea that washing robes in blood would make them white. And we've already seen mention of white robes. Those who were victorious in the letter to Sardis were given white garments, and the Laodiceans were commanded to purchase white garments. Now, what this chapter ends with is with a hymn of praise, and in that we see that God's people can indeed stand the judgment day of the Lord. And so the answer to the question, who can stand at the end of chapter 6, is answered. So those are some of the ideas that flow from reading through this chapter, and some questions that are raised. Well, what are some of the background information that perhaps can help us understand this chapter a little better. Well, first of all, Gentiles often personify the elements of nature themselves or recognized gods attached to them. Obviously, Jews would not have considered these other, would not have recognized other gods, but they attributed that they, well, the Jewish people believed that God had delegated his authority over various features of nature, including winds, to angels under his command. So four corners of the earth was meant figuratively, even in ancient times. A few people thought that the world was spherical, but most people viewed it as circular. Four corners was nevertheless conventional speech, as was the idea of four winds from the four directions of heaven. Now, the winds had both positive and negative effects in ancient sources. According to some views, the wind carried along the sun and moon chariots, or God founded the heavens on the winds, and the stoppage of winds could signal the advent of a new age. Like writers today, the biblical writers used the language conventional to the genre in which they were writing. This could include, as here, symbolic imagery. In the most popular ancient conception, Helios drove his sun chariot in a regular course above the earth, rising from the gates of the east and descending into the west to return by its path under the earth. The earth circle was surrounded on all sides by the river Oceanus. Jewish people naturally modified the sun god into an angel, but any angel that would rise in the orbit of the sun would have been recognized as superior to the greatest of the kings of the earth. So this provides a little bit of background into the imagery of angels and of winds, and of the importance that the ancient people, both Gentiles and Jews, placed upon such imagery. In regards to the numbers, symbolic numbers were standard fare in Jewish views of the future. And already we've noted that in John's visions, what he hears and what he sees are not always the same. In Revelation 1, John hears a loud voice like a trumpet. But when he looks, what he sees is one like a son of man. in Revelation 5, he hears the phrase, Lion of Judah, to describe the one who is worthy to open the scroll. But when he looks, what he sees is a lamb. And this is not necessarily unusual, because double versions of visions occur in the Old Testament. One of the prime examples is found in Genesis chapter 41. And this is the dream that Pharaoh had, one with seven good cows, and seven bad cows, as well as seven good ears of corn and seven bad ears of corn. So, similar imagery, but different. Two different dreams, but they mean the same thing. And so in Revelation, as John sees his visions, what he hears and what he sees are often different, yet they point to the same thing. And this is important in trying to figure out whether the 144,000 and the great multitude are same or different. And finally, in regards to the background, white robes were appropriate for worship in the temple and were also used for the worship of gods in Asia Minor. Palm branches were especially used in the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. In the future, the remnant of all nations would go up to Jerusalem to worship at the Feast of Tabernacles. As in apocalyptic texts, the earthly future realm is in some sense presently fulfilled in heaven. Palm branches celebrated the victory of Israel's exodus from Egypt, and the feast commemorated God's faithfulness to them during their wanderings in the wilderness, when they were totally dependent on Him. So, when chapter 7 describes this great multitude who are clothed in white robes and with palm branches in their hands, perhaps there is some of that imagery, and some of the interpretation can be taken from there, that this great multitude is fully dependent upon God, and they are celebrating their victory through God. And there are some parallels that are found between chapter 7 and chapters 4 and 5. There's a general chiastic structure. For example, there's some things that happen before the action, before the Lion of the tribe of Judah, Root of David, has conquered. And likewise, in chapter 7, there's things that happen before the servants of God are sealed. And then the action takes place. The Lamb comes and takes the scroll, and the great multitude cries out and prays. And finally, there are things that happen after the action. By the blood, didst ransom and hast made. This is chapter 5, verses 9 and 10. Now worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seal, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. And in chapter 7, verse 14, what happens after the action is, they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. This idea of blood, as well as this group that is being described in both places, in chapter 5 as well as chapter 7. So, the sense that we're getting is that these groups that are being described, these victors, those who have conquered, are the same in all of these places, whether it's in chapter 5 or in chapter 7. Some other connections between these chapters, the mention of 24 elders, the four living creatures, angels, the various songs of praise, the idea of worship, the white garments, an elder speaking to John, the blood of the Lamb. And we can, chapter 5 ended with verse 14, where it reads, "And the four living creatures said, Amen, and the elders fell down and worshipped." Verse 9 of chapter 7 could be considered a continuation of that last verse of chapter 5. Verse 9 of chapter 7 reads, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands." Now, chapter 5 ended with every creature in heaven and on earth praising God. And chapter 7, the middle of it, picks up where that left off, with a great multitude. All creatures in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea, etc., praising God. And through that, the interpretation that we can make is that this great multitude is the same as the one who is praising God, as those who are praising God at the end of chapter 5. The implication of all this, then, is that the 144,000 and the great multitude are the same. Just because there is a specific number attached to in one place and in another place it's recorded that they can't be numbered, doesn't mean that they are different groups, but rather the number serves some other kind of a function. It's symbolic, and it refers to something else rather than a literal number. And so what is it? What is this 144,000 mean? Well, let's go back to the beginning of chapter 7, where four angels are pictured as being at the four corners of the earth. Now, perhaps it is referring back to the four horsemen of Zechariah 1 and 6 that we looked into during our discussion of the first four seals. So, if so, they're doing the patrolling and the judgment. However, as we've already noted, this process of patrolling and judgment isn't necessarily limited to a single point in time, such as the end of time, but rather it's something that is taking place throughout history. The four horsemen of the first four seals, we saw that they were sent at the start of the proclamation of the gospel. And perhaps we can see this holding back of the winds as continuing throughout the sealing of God's people. And this sealing, again, isn't something that happens at the very end, but it is something that happens throughout history. As we've already discussed, God's people is the church, both past, present, and future, throughout all of history, until history itself ceases. And then a fifth angel appears, another angel, and this angel appearing can be likened to the discussion of the myth of Helios and the Jewish adaptation of Greek thought, in which this is one of the primary angels, one of the angels with far more power and authority than was considered, to be, there were different hierarchies of angels at that time, and this would be considered one of the higher ones. And this angel arrives to announce an intervention in the normal course of history. Now, if the six seals were followed in logical succession, then the unaltered course of history would be that everyone would be judged and they would perish. But what this fifth angel comes to do is to essentially pause the normal course of history, to alter it, to open up a new path, a new branch. And so, what I see is that, again, this contraindicates the 144,000 as the sealing of the 144,000 as a singular event that happens at the end of time. The idea of seal or sealing that is found in chapter 7 here is an allusion to Ezekiel chapter 9. And let me go back, let me go to that now. This is where Ezekiel has a vision. The vision is a vision of judgment on the city and the temple at Jerusalem. And I'm just going to read from this chapter, starting with verse 1. Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, "Bring near the executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand." And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand, and with them was a man clothed in linen, with a writing case at his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub on which it rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing case at his waist. And the Lord said to him, "Pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it." And to the others he said in my hearing, "Pass through the city after him and strike. Your eyes shall not spare, and you shall show no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women. But touch no one on whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary." So in Ezekiel's vision, those who are appalled by the evils that are happening in the land and the city and the temple are given marks on their foreheads and are spared. They are sealed with the mark of God, with the seal of God, and they are spared of judgment. And that is perhaps the imagery that the hearers of Revelation chapter 7 would have in regards to the 144,000. In Revelation, the angel says also to do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. It seems to be a little bit of an echo of what was found in chapter 6, verse 6. Chapter 6, verse 6 of Revelation, where a voice in the midst of four living creatures says, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine. So in some way, I think this phrase, do not harm, represents God's mercy or forbearance. In chapter 7, it's clearly, there's a clear end to when this do not harm will end. Until we have sealed the servants of our God. So it implies, at least to me, that each person must have the opportunity to rationally make a choice for or against God. So God's mercy and grace is that every person will have an opportunity to make their choice for or against God. Thus, again, this argues for a process that happens over the entire course of gospel history rather than some singular event that's limited to at the very end of time. So this process of sealing, I believe, as I read chapter 7 in light of all that we have already studied, it's a process that's been happening, that is happening, and that will continue to happen. So this number 144,000. No, it's associated with 12,000 from the tribe of Judah, from Benjamin, etc., etc. It's a census. And where have we seen censuses in the Bible before? Find it in, say, the book of Numbers. Numbers chapters 1 and 2. It's a military census. The reason why the people were numbered, and note that back in those times, it was the men that were numbered. Men of fighting age. Not the young, not the old, but those who were able to fight. It's a military census. And so it represents the functional completeness of a nation. 144,000 is mathematically 12 times 12 times 1,000. It represents a type of completeness. So we should not take the 144,000 to be a literal value to be assigned to some kind of group. If we were to take the number literally, then we should be consistent in taking the rest of chapter 7 literally. And if we were to do that, then the 144,000 must be literally Israelites, physical descent from Israel. They must be males. There must be exactly 12,000 from each listed tribe, and they must be sexual virgins, literal sexual virgins. The 144,000 is mentioned in chapter 14, verse 4, in that context. They are sexual virgins. So, anyone who takes the number 144,000 in chapter 7 to be literal, 144,000, to be consistent, has to take everything else about it to be literal. So, it's best to understand the 144,000 as a symbolic number. We've already seen that John uses the word Israel to refer to the church as a whole. We've already seen that sexual purity, when it's mentioned in Revelation, symbolizes and refers to loyalty to Jesus. And this listing of the tribes of Israel is unlike any found in the Old Testament. It's missing the tribe of Dan, while Joseph and one of his sons is included. It just doesn't happen in the Old Testament, and so this is a unique list of tribes. Now, it's possible that Dan is omitted because Dan was noted for its sins in a few places in the Old Testament and in later Jewish tradition after Revelation is written. Idolatry is specifically ascribed to the tribe of Dan, but probably shouldn't make a huge deal out of it. What we should take away, though, is that taken together, all of this information, the 144,000 should be seen purely as symbolic of the entire composition of God's people. It's the complete... It refers to the completeness of God's people. And therefore, it can be the same as the great multitude that follows immediately in the second half of chapter 7. So John is hearing 144,000, but when he looks, he sees something different. And as we have discussed a few minutes ago, this is common in Revelation, as well as in visions and dreams that are recorded in the Bible. Now, there may be multiple ways of picturing and of describing and of hearing things, yet refer to the same thing. So John is being given a picture of God's people as his army who is going out to battle through the gospel message, to battle the evil that is being caused by the world. And what is the gospel? The gospel is God or Jesus' victory and authority over death, over Hades, and over fear. Now that's one of the ways Jesus is pictured in the book of Revelation, is as holding the keys to death and Hades. Jesus has conquered the ultimate fear object of those who are not believers in God. And so in summary, we can say that the number 144,000 is symbolic of the entire church throughout history. It's not limited to a particular point in time, such as the end of time, but rather it represents a process throughout history of God identifying his people. The 144,000 and the great multitude describe different aspects of the same group which is God's people. And finally, chapter 7 describes the mercy and compassion of God for all peoples. God's mercy and compassion causes him to forestall, to postpone the natural course of judgment that ought to take place until all have been given a legitimate choice for or against him. The message of chapter 7 is that, yes, there are those who are able to stand the judgment of God, and those are the ones who have been sealed. And how does one get sealed? Well, that is described in the next part of chapter 7, which we will cover in the next session.